Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Abolition. Abolition. Today. Abolition.
As of this date, 30 to 60 days from now, anyone who is in the state of Iowa that is not here legally and cannot demonstrate their legal status to the satisfaction of the local and state authorities here in the state of Iowa, become property of the state of Iowa. And we have a job for you. And we start using compelled labor. The people who are here illegally would therefore be owned by the state and become an asset of the state rather than a liability. And we start inventing jobs for them. Well, how would you apply that logic to what Donald Trump is trying to do, to get Mexico pay for the border and for the wall? Same way. If you have come across the border illegally, we get then give them another 60-day guideline. You need to go home and leave this jurisdiction. And if you don't, you become property of the United States. And guess what? You will be building a wall. We will compel your labor. You would belong to these United States. You show up without an invitation, you get to be an asset. You get to be a construction worker. This is Fred. Good morning, Fred.
Your idea is clever on the face, but it sounds an awful lot like flavor. I think it goes over like a lead balloon. So,
you just read the Constitution, Fred. What does the Constitution say about the slavery?
Well, you know, I don't have my Constitution in front of me, and like I say, it sounds like a clever idea, and maybe you could make it put it in action, but I think the fallout would be so significant.
What would be the nature of the fallout?
Well, I think everybody would believe it sounds like slavery.
Well, what's wrong with slavery?
So are you going to house all these people that have chosen to be indentured?
Yes, yeah, absolutely, in a minimal fashion. We would take a lesson from Sheriff Arpaio down in Arizona, put up a tent village. We feed and water these new assets. We give them minimal shelter, minimal nutrition, and offer them the opportunity to work for the benefit of the taxpayers of the state of Iowa. All they have to do to avoid servitude is to leave. So you think I'm just pulling your leg? I am not.
13. Wait. How did Lord Key do it? 13. Yeah.
educated.
Let's do it, let's do it.
Family, let's get educated.
The
13th Amendment,
the mental shackles.
They want to amend it.
We breaking them shackles.
The 13th Amendment.
Yeah.
They want to amend it. Let's get educated.
Let's do it, let's do it.
So they can never take it.
They can't take it.
Let's get educated.
Let's do it.
So they can never take it. The 13th Amendment.
They want to send them chains.
They want to amend it.
They want us bound.
Let's get educated.
Let's break them chains.
So they can never take it.
Let's do it, let's do it.
Let's get educated. So they can never take it. Let's get educated. So they can never take it.
Abolition. Abolition.
You just heard on-air statements from WHO Radio talk show host Jan Mikkelsen. He's a frequent interviewer of Republican presidential candidates campaigning in Iowa. Yes, you heard him correctly. What's wrong with slavery? That was followed by 13th Amendment featuring Cage, C-A-Y-J. Do me a quick favor and click the link to that song on our Facebook page and give a like and a comment for that young brother. Peace and welcome to Abolition Today, a weekly syndicated online radio program with specific focus on modern slavery as it is practiced through the 13th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution and by for-profit prisons worldwide. We air live every Sunday at 7 p.m. Eastern. Live streams and archived podcasts are available at abolitiontoday.org. I'm your host, Max Parthas. Brother Yusuf will not be joining us this evening. He is still dealing with a family crisis, and we ask that you keep Yusuf and his family in your prayers. Brother Tag Hartman is here at the Paul Cuffey Abolitionist Center doing volunteer work, and he'll help me hold it down again. Peace, Brother Tag.
Peace.
No doubt. Tonight we bring clarity to confusion by answering the question, what is slavery? Is it mental? Is it economic? Is it physical? Is it a 9-to-5 dead-end job? Is it when you're forced to wear face masks? When you're told to stay home in a global pandemic? When you're forced to work for free? We'll get into all of that and more. Also, Tag will be reviewing an article by Scott Howe, loosely called Slavery as Punishment and the Neglected Clause in the 13th Amendment. After hearing our discussions about Marsha Ballard's new book, Slavery as Punishment, he dug deeper into her source material. We'll talk about the badges and incidents of slavery, disseminate news, offer views, and of course, play awesome music and poetry. Hang on for the next 2 hours, grab a pen and paper. The master class on modern slavery abolition has already begun. So here we go, man. Let me put the mic over here so we can share it like that. You know, we're up in the Paul Cuffey Abolitionist Center. It's been a heck of a week, as always. So much has been going on. I'm happy to say that my nephew Tiny has been found. I know for most of you, like, what are you talking about, Max? My nephew Tiny was missing for a week. So everybody was going nuts trying to find him. They called the cops, got the cops involved. Half the family became detectives and went out searching and looking for clues, like, you know, like it was Scooby-Doo up in here. And they were about to wild out. And then just about an hour ago, right, we got the news that he's all right. So it's been a roller coaster over here about that. We spent the last couple of days, Tag and I, he's kind of, you know, being a fly on the wall and working side by side with me on some of these projects. What do you think so far, man? PCAC and the work that happens there.
Oh, well, one would expect, and as you know, just so much strong and important work, you know, flourishing from through this space, and it's just been, you know, excellent to be able to peep out of the space, you know, live and direct, as it were, and just very much encouraged with what y'all have going here. So, you know, just trying to peep out and you know, do whatever I can in that regard to just continue and to support, because it's very, very much well needed and highly vital work. So
thanks, brother. Thanks.
Appreciate it.
The intro, you know, we always start with a bang, and then that was a hell of a bang right there. Jan Mikkelsen is a very popular, or was a very popular, right-wing conservative Republican talk show host. He interviewed all of the 2016 presidential candidates, including Donald Trump, and he made these statements on his radio program. And no one ever held him to task amongst all those candidates. You know, it makes you think that maybe they were looking at it as some sound advice. You know, let's use slavery on the immigrants. We're doing it on the Negroes. Might as well do it on the immigrants too, right? And here's how we can do it, why we should justify it, and even pointed out the 13th Amendment with the nerve to say, because the dude was like, yo, that's like slavery. People be flipping out. What's wrong with slavery? Have we heard that before? What's wrong with slavery? Teach the good, what would they say? Teach the bad, the ugly, and the good about slavery. We've seen it in schools where they've had questionnaires, what was good about slavery, as if, you know, it was something at all good about it. Well, first of all, we want to be certain about what we're talking about, because the man used the word slavery, right? People use the word slavery all the freaking time, and more often than not, they're using metaphors or synonyms or something from Greek philosophers or Roman historians, or they're talking about involuntary servitude, or, as I said earlier, it's just face masks. But we're slavery abolitionists, and what we're looking to do is end the exception clauses within the 13th Amendment itself, and also within state constitutions, and to provide constitutional protection from slavery and involuntary servitude in the states that have none at this point, which is about 25 of them have no language whatsoever. And what is it that we're fighting against? What do we want to abolish, right? That needs to be defined. Because, you know, you could ask different people what is slavery, and you're likely going to get different answers, depending on who you ask. Some people even compare chattel slavery to Roman slavery, or Greek slavery, or even to Hebrew slavery. And that's just not the case. Chattel slavery is unique in American history. So let's get right into it and answer that question off the bat, all right? What we narrowed it down to, considering our requirements, was we needed something that the United States has signed on to, where, you know, they've said, yes, we agree with this, and that other nations as well have signed on to as an agreement of a definition, legal definition, of slavery, and also how you can determine if or not something is slavery. And I've taken counsel with some wise people, constitutional attorneys, United Nations representatives, the Queen of Benin just the other day, yes, on a committee for the United Nations, spoke with her, my brother Dennis Febo, and he also was speaking with other people to try to help to clear this up. So we need to be able to address this on a legal basis. That's very important. So when we talk about slavery and we talk about abolishing something, then legally, what is this thing that we're abolishing? And what we narrowed it down to was the Bellagio-Harvard Guideline on the Legal Parameters of Slavery. I'm just going to go ahead into this, and we're going to try to get through all of it before the evening is out. We'll probably break it up into parts. So let me start out with it first. We, the members of the Research Network on the Legal Parameters of Slavery, recognizing that there has been a lack of legal clarity with regards to the interpretation of the definition of slavery in international law, conscious that the starting point for understanding that definition is Article 1, parentheses 1, of the 1926 Slavery Convention, which reads, slavery is the status or condition of a person over whom any or all of the powers attaching to the right of ownership are exercised. Let me read that once again. Slavery is the status or condition of a person over whom any or all of the powers attached to the right of ownership are exercised. Recalling that this definition is reproduced in substance in Article 7A of the 1956 Supplementary Convention on the Abolition of Slavery, the slave trade and institutions and practices similar to slavery. Also noting that the 1926 definition of slavery is once again reproduced in substance in the definition of enslavement found in Article 7-2C of the 1998 Statute of the International Criminal Court and developed in more detail in the secondary legislation of the court in its elements of crimes, bearing in mind the provisions in international human rights law regarding slavery within the 1948 Universal Declaration and 1966 International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, as well as the provisions regarding slavery in regional human rights conventions of the African, European, and Inter-American systems. Considering the inclusion of slavery as an enumerated type of human exploitation in both the 2000 United Nations Palermo Protocol on Trafficking in Persons and the 2005 Council of Europe Convention on Action Against Trafficking in Human Beings, mindful of the pronouncements and case law related to slavery of international, regional, and domestic courts. Having met to consider the issue at the 2010 symposium entitled The Perimeters of Slavery at the Rockefeller Foundation's Bellagio Conference centered in Bellagio, Italy, having further deliberated in 2011 at a meeting under the auspices of the Harriet Tubman Institute for Research on the Global Migrations of African Peoples, York University, Canada, and came together once more at the 2011 symposium entitled The Legal Perimeters of Slavery, Historical to the Contemporary at Harvard University, under the auspices of the Charles Hamilton Houston Institute for Race and Justice, Harvard Law School, the Harvard Sociology Department, the W.E.B. Du Bois Institute, recommend the following guidelines related to legal parameters of slavery. So I'm going to stop right there because that just tells you that, you know, in the legal lease, they took all this into consideration, the power, the weight of what they were taking on to define what exactly is slavery. And it says guideline number one, the legal definition. The legal definition of slavery in international law is found in Article 1 of the 1926 Slavery Convention, which reads, slavery is the status or condition of a person over whom any or all of the powers attached to the right of ownership are exercised. So let's get into that right away. Tag, comments on that?
Yeah, there seems to be this continuous reference back to ownership, and ownership being somewhere near the essence of the definition of slavery that we're seeing here.
Yes, yes. You know, a lot of times we kind of point at prison labor as the core identifier of slavery in the United States and worldwide with prison labor. Because we do say that China's using prison labor too, and that's slavery, right? But that's not the only thing. Because when you say slave labor, remember, the labor has a word that comes before it, slave. And that's the root of it right there, ownership. If you, what do they say? Whether any or whole. Let me read it one more time over here where it says, any or all of the powers attaching to the right of ownership. So you could portray yourself as having power, just one power over part of one part of someone's life. I control your Tuesdays. I own you on Tuesdays. You know what I mean? That you could be just that, and that still would qualify. All right. So guideline number two, the exercise of powers attaching to the right of ownership. In cases of slavery, the exercise of the powers attaching to the right of ownership should be understood as constituting control over a person in such a way as to significantly deprive that person of his or her individual liberty with the intent of exploitation through the use, management, profit, transfer, or disposal of that person. Usually, this exercise will be supported by and obtained through means such as violent force, deception, and or coercion. Now, I can already start seeing the connections right there to modern day prison for profit, leasing for profit, right on through that 13th Amendment exception clause. What about you, Ted?
Right there, in agreement of that, as far as the observations are concerned, I see just right there at the end some key words and the actions that go behind those words, such as violent force, such as deception, and such as coercion. And so all of those are deployed against those of us who find ourselves behind these walls sanctioned by the 13th Amendment exception clause as slavery.
Right, exactly. And you know, since the 13th Amendment says key moment where you become property is duly convicted. So once you've been duly convicted, how is it that people get to that point of duly conviction, right? What's the number one way people end up duly convicted and the click moment happens? Well, those are through plea bargains. 94% state, I believe, and 97% federal, and in a plea bargain. So if, according to the Sixth Amendment, you're supposed to have a fair and speedy trial by a jury of your peers and access to competent counsel and representation, and you're not getting that, then that means you're being coerced. You're forced now. You know, you're going to get 100 years if you go to court. But if you take this deal, I'm going to give you 5 years and probation. What do you think most people are going to say? Even if they didn't commit the damn crime, you're up against district attorneys who have unlimited funding, and you have nothing. You don't even have competent counsel. So we end up with a rate of 95%. Of all federal cases ending in plea bargains, like an assembly line of flesh and bone. So it definitely fits guideline two. Excuse me. Let's do guideline number three. Possession is foundational to slavery. Man, it sounds like church up in here, don't it? Possession is foundational to slavery. Where there is a right of ownership and respect of a thing, ownership implies a background relation of control. That control is the power attaching to the right of ownership known as possession. Possession is foundational to an understanding of the legal definition of slavery, even when the state does not support a proprietary right in respect of persons. To determine in law a case of slavery, one must look for possession. While the exact form of possession may vary, in essence, it supposes control over a person by another such as a person might control a thing. Such control may be physical, but physical constraints will not always be necessary to the maintenance of effective control over a person. More abstract manifestations of control of a person might be evident in attempts to withhold identity documents or to otherwise restrict free movement or access to state authorities or legal processes, or equally in attempts to forge a new identity through compelling a new religion, language, place of residence, or forcing marriage. Fundamentally, where such control operates, it will significantly deprive that person of his or her individual liberty for a period of time, which is, for that person, indeterminate. Cases of slavery are to be distinguished from those where, though there has been control exercised, it does not constitute control tantamount to possession, such as where employers make legitimate decisions about the management of workers. Possession is foundational in that not only is it a power attaching to the right of ownership, it also creates the factual conditions for the exercise of any or all of other powers attaching to the right of ownership, such as those set out in guideline number four. All right, so that's guideline number three. Again, you know, I saw some things right off the bat that directly point to our criminal justice and prison system. Okay?
Oh, well, without question, and yeah, this term of possession and the concept of possession should seem to have a number of different relevant definitions and usages out here as regards the 13th Amendment exception clause, as regards the carceral system in general.
One of the things that came to mind for me is a quote that came from Officer Patrick Lundgren of Lever Correctional Institute in Bridgeville, South Carolina. And he said, you control every part of their life, and if you're doing it right, they can't do anything to you. Isn't that the type of control tantamount to possession when you say you control every part of their life? They can't go to the bathroom without you. They can't get medical attention without you. They can't talk without you. Like, literally, they can't walk without you. And if they've been without you, they're subject to punishment and retribution, all the way up to and including torture. And in prisons, especially, you have the kangaroo courts inside who suddenly can determine how many more years have added to your sentencing. I remember a few years back when we organized one of the largest prison slave labor work strikes in history. The brothers inside got a hold of contraband cell phones and used that to organize and share that information on Facebook. And then the prison found out and gave them a year for every post. So one brother had over 30 posts. Guess what he got? Over 30 years given by a warden in a prison and not in a court. He could have been on his last year for all we know, and suddenly, poof, 30 years gone. And that was just the least of what they were due to him. They also took off 7 years of commissary and 7 years of being able to get the things that he needs. They took another guy's phone calls off for life. The punishment was extreme, beyond anything that suited what they had done and trying to organize for the rights to be recognized as human beings. Because remember in South Carolina, they had a massacre there, killing, I think it was 7 people that was killed. And it took hours for them to get everything under control. And it began all over the conditions, 8th Amendment violations documented by the DOJ. Anything you want to add to that, Ted?
Well, not necessarily to add to that. Essentially, that's what it sounds like. The parallels and the continuities are ongoing, and they continue in their relevance. Questions of communications, telecommunications, just generally part of what is clearly not wanted by these systems that engage in human trafficking and enslavement is more information from the perspective of those who are suffering under it. That's what we see time and again, that kind of information, that kind of clarity, and those experiences are kept at bay to whatever degree they can do so.
Yes, sir. Well, I want to make sure that everybody remembers, if you call in and you have a question or a comment, press 1 on your keypad so we know it's you, because people call in just because they listen using their phone. So press number 1 on your keypad so that we know you have a question or comment. The number, if you do want to participate in this conversation, is 515-605-9814. 515-605-9814. All right, let's go ahead and read guideline number 4, since guideline number 3 references it, right? Number 4 says, further examples of power attaching to the right of ownership, where a person controls another, such as he or she would control a thing only. Such possession makes possible the exercise of any or all of the powers attaching to the right of ownership. Collectively, the exercise of any or all of the powers attaching to the right of ownership may serve to indicate the presence of control of a person tantamount to possession, and so provide evidence of slavery. The following are further examples of powers attached to the right of ownership. then they go with A, buying, selling, or transferring a person. Before I go into the further description, we already know that through prison stocks and jail bonds, you can buy and sell people. Because that's how it works, you know what I mean? They try to play it off like you're investing in the prisons, but the prisons are useless without people. So you really invest in the fact that people are going to fill those prisons, like that little clip we heard from the GEO group when it was selling the Clinton Correctional Facility and talking about how you're going to have, no matter what your industry is, what you're looking for, you will have a steady supply of product coming through this pipeline here in America. And the product they were talking about was people, because it was a prison they were auctioning off. So buying and selling is definitely part of the process here, and transferring is certainly also involved in that too, because we have human trafficking within our prison systems. An example would be Eloy, Arizona, right? So they got this prison in Eloy, Arizona, that when it was first built, basically was built to house only Hawaiians. So if you broke a law in Hawaii, they would send you to a for-profit prison in freaking Arizona. And, you know, Vermont does the same thing. Vermont ships prisons over to Michigan and Mississippi. And Mississippi is the hellhole with their prisons. And they send in Vermonters to this hellhole in Mississippi where they never committed any crimes. So this is human trafficking. All right, let's continue. Buying, selling, or otherwise transferring a person may provide evidence of slavery. Have establishing control tantamount to possession. The act of buying, selling, or transferring that person will be an act of slavery, period. Evidence of slavery may also be found in similar transactions, such as bartering, exchanging, or giving or receiving a person as a gift, where control tantamount to possession has been established. Wow. Think long and hard about certain circumstances today that would be the equivalent of giving a person as a gift, right? All right, and B, using a person. Using a person may provide evidence of slavery, having established control tantamount to possession. The act of using that person will be an act of slavery. Now, you got to have that control, like the CEO said out there in South Carolina, if you control all of their lives, and you're doing it right, every moment of their lives, they can't do nothing to you. So you have to have this control tantamount to possession to achieve this. Evidence of such use of a person may include the derived benefit from the services or labor of that person. In such cases, a person might be used by working for little or no pay, utilized for sexual gratification, or used by providing a service. And before we go into C, let's make some commentary on what we just heard right there. Okay?
Yeah, this, you know, it gets into some of the countless heinous aspects of enslavement and all of the exploitation that entails. And when you get into some of the specifics and examples of such heinous exploitation, it can be difficult to encounter, certainly, but it's the realities are what they are, and it's important that defining something as systematic as enslavement includes those particulars, and there are all kinds of ethical and you know, you name it, questions to think about as far as how you go on to represent or depict or acknowledge these realities, but acknowledging them is necessity.
Yes, and I also saw the examples. I was, you know, as I'm reading this, I'm like, okay, where do I see this in the prison system? So under using a person, we were just talking about today where the detective has faced 35 counts of rape. He was raping black men, this detective, right?
Yep.
Running around at gunpoint, in the jails, raping them, in the streets, raping them, all around the city of Philadelphia. This detective was raping men at gunpoint. And that's all part of that process of slavery. You see it there. The same example, another example would be in Tutwiler Prison in Alabama with the women that had to go through a couple of decades of guards raping them, where they had abortion clinics right there on the prison's property because the guard, they were getting pregnant so often. Some of them even had babies that were given to this Russian-run adoption center. There, I forget the name of it. But this was happening in while in prison to the women in Alabama. There was another one in New York where the women were being forced to give blowjobs for personal items they would need for sanitary items. They would have to do strip dances for toothpaste. If they wanted to make a phone call, they had to have lesbian sex with each other in front of the guards. These were the things they were living through. And it fits all of that description in using a person. So you don't have to have it happen everywhere. You just have to have these things happening within that system for the entire system to be a problem. All right, let's go to number C. Managing the use of a person. Managing the use of a person may provide evidence of slavery. Having established control tantamount to possession, the act of managing that person will be an act of slavery. Of such management of the use of a person may include indirect management, such as a brothel owner delegating power to a day manager in a situation of slavery in the context of sex work. All right, so, you know, not a lot to say right there. That's pretty clear. We can see it, right? Everything doesn't apply always to just the prison industry we're dealing right here, because there's various forms of slavery, like sex slavery, child slavery, and things like that. All right, so let's go into D. Profiting from the use of a person. Now, this is a big one. You know that's happening here, man. Louisiana, you listening to me, right? California, y'all hear me, right? Your forest fire is about to have a big season, I suspect. That there's going to be thousands of prisoners out there working for, what, $1 a day and a potential day off if they risk their life? All right. Profiting from the use of a person, D. Profiting from the use of a person may provide evidence of slavery. Having established control tantamount to possession, the act of profiting from the use of that person will be an act of slavery. Evidence of profiting from the use of a person may include cases where a person is mortgaged, lent for profit, or used as collateral. Evidence of profiting from the use of a person may also include making money or deriving any other kind of income or benefit from the use of the person, such as the use of an agricultural worker in a situation of slavery, where the profit from the picking of a crop is taken or received by another, whether in the form of wages or of the harvest. So that's D. And we've got one, D, E. We've got two more in this category. So let's go on moving to E. And if you feel like you need to stop me, so you want to make a comment on something, let me know, all right?
Absolutely.
And let me check the phone lines real quick. Nope. All right. Remember to press 1 if you have something to say. So transferring a person to an heir or a successor. Transferring a person to an heir or a successor may provide evidence of slavery, having established control over a person tantamount to possession. The act of willing that person to a child or other heirs or successor will be an act of slavery. Evidence of such transferring of a person may include a case of inheritance where a woman on the death of her husband is deemed to be inherited by another person. Evidence of such a transferring of a person may also include the conveying of a status or condition of a person to that of a successive generation, such as from mother to daughter. So they're obviously talking about in some nations where if you die, the brother takes on the role of husband, the next oldest brother takes on the role of husband will be an example of that. And also the antebellum period where you were born a slave and your children were born a slave and you died a slave, and literally they will put you into the will, much like Martha Washington had in her will with the, I think it was 90 or so people that she claimed to own. 83, actually. 83. All right, and F, disposal, mistreatment or neglect of a person. Disposing of a person following his or her exploitation may provide evidence of slavery. Having established establish control over a person tantamount to possession. The act of disposing of a person will be an act of slavery. Mistreatment or neglect of a person may provide evidence of slavery. Having established control tantamount to possession, such disregard may lead to the physical or psychological exhaustion of a person and ultimately to his or her destruction. Accordingly, the act of bringing about such exhaustion will be an act of slavery. Evidence of such mistreatment or neglect may include sustained physical and psychological abuse, whether calculated or indiscriminate, or the imposition of physical demands that severely curtail the capacity of the human body to sustain itself or function effectively. First thing that comes into my mind, man, is Hugo Pinnell's daughter. I was speaking with her the other day, courtesy of Sister Jamelia Ladd, and she was telling me about her father spending 46 years in solitary confinement. I'm pretty sure that 46 years being tortured certainly fits the description there, right? And he's not alone, because Albert Woodfox was 43 years, and there's many others that have close to as many years as that in solitary confinement, which the United Nations has all agreed that this is torture. All right, so that takes care of everything up to guidelines number 4. So with that, I want to take a pause. Let me check the phone lines again to make sure I'm not missing anybody. Remember, press 1 if you want to give a question or comment. Otherwise, we won't know it. And the call-in number is 515-605-9814. Now, in addition to this description and definition of slavery, there's also the issue of badges and incidents of slavery. Because once you identify these things, we're in agreement. This is what we're trying to abolish, this thing right here. And here are all of the elements of it as proof and evidence of control tantamount to owning a person, right? We have all of that there. In addition to that, there's effects that happen. Many misidentify them as legacies of slavery or leftovers from slavery, but they're actually called badges and incidents of slavery. And Congress has the ability to make laws that would change and address those things directly, according to Section 2 of the 13th Amendment. In order to help you understand that more, I want to play a clip that we have, and it's called Badges and Incidents of Slavery. It's Professor William Carter Jr., and he's from the a professor of law at the University of Pittsburgh, and he breaks down that as well as a moment in time where we literally have the birth of America, the second founding of America. I think I'll let him explain it all. You're listening to Abolition Today. I'm Max Fontes. I'm here with Brother Tag Harmon today.
Peace.
And we'll be right back after this.
Abolition. Abolition.
In terms of what I plan to focus on, I'm going to be best to talk about 2 of my articles that I guess kind of span a spectrum of my writing about race and the law. So the first one is called A 13th Amendment Framework for Combating Racial Profiling. And that one, I think, was published maybe in 2004, 2005. It was one of my first big articles. And that one looks at the issue of racial profiling through the lens of the 13th Amendment and through a lesser known aspect of the 13th Amendment, that it prohibited not only literal slavery, but also what its framers called the badges and incidents of slavery. Those modern day conditions that are a legacy of slavery or that were an outgrowth of it. And so in that article, I argue that a wide-scale system of criminal suspicion based upon skin color is a badge or incident of slavery, because it mirrors, even if not driven by the same purpose, the kind of racialized control over autonomy and freedom of movement that black slaves, as well as all free blacks, were subject to during slavery. So I'll talk a little bit about that one piece, and I know that David and Jalila will have a lot to contribute there because of their own work about race and the criminal law. The other piece is much more recent. In fact, it's still a draft. It's been accepted by the Texas Law Review, but hasn't been published yet. It'll come out next year. And it's about freedom of speech and slavery. So the idea of that one, again, kind of drawing on the legal history of slavery, is that, in my view, as well as in the view of many other scholars, we have two distinct constitutional regimes. There's the framing to Civil War regime, right, the 1787 to 1865 Constitution, which I'll call the original founding. And then there's what's referred to as the second founding, the post-Civil War constitutional amendments, as well as federal civil rights statutes, that the people at the time who adopted them thought of as representing a second American Revolution, a second founding of the nation, in turning away from a society based on racial slavery to one who, at least in its fundamental charter, would be based upon freedom and equality for all persons, not merely a subset. In constitutional doctrine, as you'll recall, the cases, and indeed I would say probably most professors, spend very little time talking about the second founding as a new constitutional moment. We talk a lot about specific provisions from the post-Civil War Constitution, right? So you spend a ton of time on equal protection, due process, privileges and immunities, etc. But in general, when we talk about the pre-Civil War Constitution, we tend to act as if the second founding moment never happened. For purposes of this paper, I contend that courts tend to act as if what freedom of speech meant in 1791 when the Bill of Rights was ratified is exactly the same thing from an original meaning perspective as what it should mean today. And my point is actually not so much to kind of claim or disclaim originalism. It is simply if you're going to analyze the Constitution from an originalist perspective, there is another originalist moment where the original framers' view was modified, elaborated upon, and in some cases rejected by the second framing. And so the article in one sense is kind of a theoretical plea that we take the post-Civil War Constitution seriously as a second founding moment. The second, more specific part is, if you accept that frame, which certainly not everyone would, what might it mean for how we interpret some specific constitutional provisions? And one of those is the First Amendment. So the, I think, kind of most novel contribution that the article makes is that it looks at freedom of speech, not just through the lens of the first founding framers, nor exclusively through the lens of the second founding framers, but that actually foregrounds the views of enslaved persons themselves and asks, what did freedom of speech mean to them in a condition of slavery? What denial of their free speech rights did they experience? What would they have hoped or expected the post-Civil War vision of freedom of speech to entail? And I argue that as part of the constitutional polity that would help us understand the general public meaning of freedom of speech under the post-Civil War Constitution, that the voices of enslaved persons have been almost entirely ignored in constitutional interpretation. So I draw from a lot of first-person slave narratives where the slaves talk about their experiences with being denied freedom of speech and talk about what they think it should mean under the reconstructed Constitution. So I'll be talking about those in the talk, and you know, hopefully folks will find it interesting. But I think what all of my 13th Amendment work, including this most recent piece, are trying to do is to show there is a different constitutional legal history that has largely remained untold, right? That particularly the post-Civil War Constitution was one that was about equal dignity and equal worth and about freedom and liberty in many aspects. Some of them were liberty of body and movement, which is the racial profiling piece. Some of them are liberty of mind and conscience, right, which is the First Amendment piece. But the animating impulse is the same, that, you know, there's a long debate about whether our Constitution was originally pro-slavery or anti-slavery. And my point, I guess, the intervention I make in my work is that in seeking to answer that question, we have to look at our Constitution as a whole. And too often our courts and lawyers act as if the post-Civil War Constitution didn't really happen.
Abolition. 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 Welcome back to Abolition Today with Max Farkas and today, Tag Harmon. So he broke it down to a degree there, and explain how that second founding should be really a point for us, but instead it was not. Also the badges and incidents of slavery. He used the First Amendment as an example. I would like to know if he's tried that with the Sixth Amendment or the Eighth Amendment, which we know are being violated habitually now, without any kind of anything happened because of that. So I'm curious. I'll look further into that. What do you think, Jack?
Well, I thought that the question of originalism was mad intriguing. That's also on issue in the article that I want to discuss at some point if minutes allow, and that seems like one area of overlap between the questions being addressed just now on audio and some of what Scott Howe seems to be looking to get at as far as the originalist interpretations of the Constitution and how that might be interpreted in different periods.
Over the past couple of months, we've been talking about Marsha Ballard and her book, Enslavement as Punishment. She also did a video where she discusses her book, and we used a few of her clips last week. You heard the clip where she made the proposal that part of, well, like our Miranda rights, when you're initially arrested, not only should you be informed that you have a right to remain silent, you have a right to attorney, anything you say it can and will be used against you in a court of law, not only should they tell you that, but they should also tell you that if you should be convicted of the crime you're being arrested for, you may end up as a slave, losing all rights and privileges as citizens. And we, last week, was like, damn, imagine, I can only imagine the face of the first person to hear that said to them. You know what I mean? Crime would drop real quick, wouldn't it?
And
I'm going to be a what?
Real, and it's a very practical approach to some of the challenges that we face. And certainly a change like that does not represent, you know, the abolition of slavery, for example, but it certainly represents a measure that has a common sense value to it that could help us to defend against the various and multifarious tentacles of prison slavery.
You dug a little deeper in her sources, which was what's his name? Dave Howe?
Okay. Yes, Scott Howe.
Scott Howe. You found Scott Howe, which she had pointed to about 8 or 9 times in her book there. And you read some of his work. Want to tell us what you found?
Absolutely. So to continue off of the thread of originalism and how that relates to what Scott Howe is looking to outline here, this is from, as has been pointed toward, Scott Howe's Slavery as Punishment, Original Public Meaning, Cruel and Unusual Punishment Clause in the 13th Amendment. And the sister, Marsha Ballard, draws from this text, among others, in her recent Enslavement as Punishment, which sounds, and from what I've seen, is extremely strong and thoroughly supportive. And so part of what Scott Howe here is pointing toward is that you can't claim, according to Howe, that there was some lack of knowledge or information at the time that the 13th Amendment was passed and ratified and became law and the exception clause included, that there would have been plenty of public information and public knowledge of what all that might entail, being enslavement. And so part of what Howe is demonstrating here or looking to show through the history is that the public meaning, the original public meaning, should be how we derive the intended meaning, quote unquote, or what this constitutional language, this amendment language, would have meant. And that from an originalist standpoint, it's less, there's less point in trying to interpret the intent of those Sufic framers, if you will, or these early those who were framing the language of the Constitution and of these amendments, but that it should go off of the public meaning, the original public meaning, and that and that there was plenty of information about conditions of enslavement at this time to indicate that it would have some of these abhorrent consequences, you know, abhorrent being just one of the descriptors used to point toward forms of enslavement and the substance of enslavement over these past centuries through the 13th Amendment exception clause. And so that's more or less the thrust of the argument from what I can glean as not a legal, you know, I'm no kind of lawyer or anything to that effect, but it struck me as with regard to the legal scholarship that I've seen, it struck me as more involved in questions of the ongoing relevance of the 13th Amendment Clause through 1865, through the postbellum period. It expressed that more than I'm used to in a lot of these this legal scholarship that I've come across. And so so that's for just one example and just pointing toward the overlap. Questions of badges and incidents of slavery do arise in this text as well. And full quote, there's a section C, the punishment clause. This is on page 992 of Scott Howe's article. And it starts to ask some questions rooted in what the focus of the original debate was around the 13th Amendment. And so the quote goes, "The focus of the original debate about the 13th Amendment was not on its punishment clause, but on its central prohibition and its second section on enforcement." And then it goes on to say, "Did the amendment prohibit only a, quote, condition of enforced compulsory service, or also certain, quote, badges, incidents, and indicia, end quote, that accompanied the racially based chattel slavery that had existed in the antebellum South?" And that section continues going into some of the potential interpretations subsequent to, if we're talking about badges and incidents, and also indicia, which is similar, speaking of index, questions of index and you know, the pointing towards that would indicate badges and incidents. And so asking, you know, is this what we're talking about as well with this 13th Amendment and its exception clause? And so part of what's pointing toward is the fact that at the time, Howe's argument is that available information around what slavery consisted of was so plentiful, you know, that and even citing, for example, you know, Harriet Beecher Stowe's work and Uncle Tom's Cabin and such, and the growing public availability of descriptions and testimony around what enslavement entails, you know, it's pointing toward the fact that by using such clear language as slavery, as well as indentured servitude, and having them both included in that particular clause, there would have been there clearly was not a great deal of question at the time as to what slavery could constitute, and that it was the lack of challenge around that as compared to, for example, this other question, the initial focus according to Howe, which was on the second section on enforcement, and this question of Congress, that Congress is the one that's entitled to enforce this, at least according to Howe's research, is the one that was much more well documented as to the debate and argument at the time of its passing. And so it goes on. It talks about the what is termed the dual character of the slave, according to, and it uses that language, quote, "the slave, that is certainly not my right. you know, language or how I would describe any such individuals whatsoever. But its language speaks to the slave had a dual character which caused tension in how the law viewed the, quote, master-slave relationship. And so that, too, was an interesting section as far as, you know, how different concepts of enslavement have tried to approach this question. So this so-called dual character, we're talking about the belief or the legal construct, the legal fiction, as it refers to at another point in this article, of a dual character of a person and property. So that a slave, quote unquote, was both person and property, and that this dual character created all kinds of issues, but also led to a lot of ambiguity around the law with respect to those who are enslaved.
Like being three-fifths human regarding the number of representatives in Congress. Yeah, was there more to that?
There was. I'm happy to pause there.
We can do a couple more minutes if you want.
Completely, you know, on your call, if you want to address a few more of them, I have some other spots quoted from the article.
Well, this is all supporting information to what we're saying here today. We're identifying what slavery is, and also the badges and incidents of slavery. And he mentioned a few of those in there as well. So this is valuable knowledge. It's one of the reasons why we call it a masterclass, right? You know, and we're learning out loud right along with you. There are no courses for this. So there's very few places where you can get all this and try to make sense of. So today we're all about what is slavery, like legally, what is slavery? And it has to include the issues that surround slavery, the badges and incidents of slavery, especially since Congress has that power. As you said, it's well documented. That's where most of the power to control this thing right now is. But we have to call it what it is in order to be able to point out these incidents and badges. You can't point out incidents and badges of mass incarceration. That's just not how it works. You don't point out incidents and badges of policing for profit or prison for profit. It has to be what? Incidents and badges of slavery. And so it's important that we identify these things properly and hold them under the legal content, because accountability is important. Accountability is key. As a matter of fact, this June 12th, I will be part of a panel discussion with Dr. Joy James and Dr. Jared Paul about accountability. I think I have the link up here for you. But that'll be June 12th. So look at our page here, Abolition Today, on Facebook for more information for that. You're definitely going to want to hear that, because I don't get to often talk about accountability. And I'm looking forward to having that opportunity. All right, so we want to finish off the Bellagio Harvard document and go through the final parts of it. We're about 60% through it, but before we do that, now that we have a better perspective with this inclusive information, I want to take a music break. And when we come back on the other side of that music break, we'll get into guideline number 5. And if we have a call or two, we'll take that. You're listening to Abolition Today with Max Parthas and Tag Harmon tonight. Brother Yusuf is dealing with family emergencies. And his birthday was just a couple days ago, so wish him happy birthday. And set up some good vibes and prayers for his family. We're at abolitiontoday.org. Our archives are available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You can learn about this anytime you feel like it. We'll be right back after this.
Abolition today. You know, we all think that slavery ended after the Civil War with the 13th Amendment. Not true. We just put walls around it. Check this out. Leave your comments. Ding the bell. Share it with your friends and subscribe to our channel. 13th Amendment. We've been talking about the 12th Amendment and how that might lead to, an absolute screaming, flaming disaster this fall and winter. I mean, it could get really, really ugly. But the 13th Amendment was the amendment that ended slavery in the United States. And everybody talks about it like, hey, it ended slavery. Isn't that cool? Well, it didn't end slavery. The 13th Amendment did not end slavery. It narrowed it. It said that you may only have slaves in the United States, enslaved persons, if it is done under the color of law. If a person is convicted of a crime, then the state may choose to sell them into slavery. You don't believe me? Look up the 13th Amendment. It's right there. So as a result of this, for, you know, 100 and some odd years, I think the 13th Amendment was ratified in the mid to late 1870s. And as a result of this, what we have is prison labor. And you've got a whole bunch of for-profit corporations who've jumped in on this. Hey, you know, it's like, these are the modern-day plantation owners. They are running slavery enterprises. Now, this does not happen in any other civilized country in the world, any other developed country in the world. But it does happen here. And it's one of the reasons that while we are 4% of the world's population, we have 20% of the world's prisoners. Probably three-quarters of those prisoners are there because, hey, it's slave labor. Let's make the most of this. I find it interesting that we have 20% of the world's deaths from COVID, too. I was looking at those numbers yesterday, and somebody was like, yeah, we're 4% of the world's population, 4.5% of the world's population. We have 20% of the world's COVID deaths. And I thought, well, that's interesting. We also have 20% of the world's prisoners. And so, you know, here we are. But anyhow, the University of Florida, day before yesterday, announced that they will no longer use slave labor in 2020. The University of Florida has relied on prison and jail inmates to provide farm labor. This is from a press release, actually. It's a statement by President Ken Fuchs of the University of Florida. The title of his statement was "Another Step Toward Positive Change Against Racism." He's noting that most of the people who are imprisoned and then sent out for slave labor are people of color, African-Americans and Hispanics principally. He said there are agricultural operations where the University of Florida has relied on prison and jail inmates to provide farm labor. The symbolism of inmate labor is incompatible with our university and its principles, and therefore this practice will end. Now, in Florida, it's literally slave labor. I mean, the people doing the work don't get anything. In California, they might get a little bit, you know, $1 an hour, 50 cents an hour. In many states, it's basically, you know, just pennies on the dollar. So it's slave labor, but they have this little thin veneer, this kind of stain, you know, this very thin layer over the top saying, oh, no, this is capitalism. We're paying them. Right. One of the companies in this space, one of the corporations in this space, and one of their promotions for, you know, buy our stock, described the detained immigrants. This is one of the companies that has built, you know, because they are detained under color of law as well, so they are subject to slavery or enslavement in the United States. They described the people in their prison, paid for by you and me to the tune of as much as $700 per day, as, quote, a readily available captive labor force. And we've got corporations using prison labor all over the country, not just state governments, not just state universities. It's just mind-boggling.
Cease to agitate, we will, when the slave whip's bound is steel. When no more hope gives this limb, fetters cut this earthly grim. When no more hounds thirst for blood, scouring the thorny Georgian woods. When no more a mother's pleading prayer quivers on the southern air. On that day, we will be family equal, born and free. Dawn will come, night will cease. We'll rejoice, mind at ease. For that day will work its way
day. Still pushing for equal pay. Mm-hmm. And he's treated right, no hope. They're shining like the Judas gold. Mm-hmm. And the stain of blood remains, a mother's only son slain. Mm-hmm. Our kids crying out for more, continually being ignored. On that day, we will be family, equal, born and free. Dawn will come, light will cease, we'll rejoice mightily. For that day we'll work and wait, that's when we'll cease to agitate.
You just heard the Tom Hartman program with Tom Hartman talking about how slavery never ended. And that was followed by the Song of the Agitators from Corey Wendell McClellan. If you get a chance, go ahead and like that too. You know, those guys who are out here really trying to bring light to this instance and using their talents, and they sound fantastic. They're doing a great job. Show them some love. The one brother that we started with had like 2 likes. This one right here only had 25. I'm like, what? How can this brother right here is what is called a freedom singer. His entire album is like this, and you should check him out. His name, once again, is Corey Wendell McClellan. And, of course, Tom Hartman really drove a lot of it home, especially what we've been talking about all night. He was showing the instances of how this is, what is described in the Bellagio Harvard guidelines. All right, so speaking of the Bellagio guidelines, let's get up to number 5. Number 5 says, making a determination as to whether slavery exists. Now, this is key, right? This is the point where you're supposed to go, is it slavery? So let's go here and state and read. The exercise of any or all of the powers attached to the right of ownership, just considered, shall provide evidence of slavery in so far as they demonstrate control over a person tantamount to possession. We've seen that throughout all of this, right? It's the key thing, to demonstrate control over a person tantamount to possession. And it doesn't require force.
No, it does not require, and it doesn't say that it requires force.
Right. Accordingly, in determining whether slavery exists in a given case, it is necessary to examine the particular circumstances, asking whether powers attached to the right of ownership are being exercised, so as to demonstrate control of a person tantamount to their possession. In evaluating the particular circumstances to determine whether slavery exists, references should be made to the substance and not simply to the form of the relationship in question. The substance of the relationship should be determined by investigating whether, in fact, there has been an exercise of one or more of the powers attached to the right of ownership. This will include a determination as to whether control tantamount to possession is present. Man, that is pretty clear. The 13th Amendment codifies it, says it right there, except the person is duly convicted, right? So now you become property. And then what happens once you get in? You're a number now, right? You don't even have the rights of a citizen. Anybody else that has, you don't have them while you're in the prisons. You don't even get them while you, when you get out of the prison. You leave without your rights and may never get them back again, right? And control is absolute. We're talking about a prison. And, you know, the problem is the cunning of the slaver class. When they decided to mix their criminal justice with their slave trade, they left everybody confused. Because how are we supposed to know who's actually guilty and who's not? How are we supposed to know if that person broke a law, then he deserves to be in jail? But the law's unjust, you know?
Yep.
They knew exactly what they were doing. I was told today by a brother when it was talking about, you know, how are we going to replace the system if we take the system apart? What do you do to replace it? Like, why would you want to replace a crime against humanity? You know what I mean? Like, who wants to do that?
Right.
And that's the mindset of the slaver class. We can't lose this money. It's too big to fail. If it fails, look what happened in Willacy County with the prisons out there in Texas. You know what I mean? The whole county went bankrupt. Could you imagine if the Colorado's prison system failed? You know how many counties depend on those prison systems? In Arizona, in California, man, we had forest fires that would burn down to the ground, wouldn't we? Yes, I think we clearly have shown here that what is known as mass incarceration in the United States, it fits all of the guidelines required in order to determine if slavery exists. This, because there is certainly control over a person tantamount to possession. Not even tantamount, it literally in writing says it. Slavery is abolished except for prisoners duly convicted.
Well, to connect it right back up to this Howe article that, you know, I've been peeping out a little bit and drawing from in connection to our broader discussion around slavery and definition, it points toward, and so case law, you know, we were just, of course, talking a bit about the, you know, the concept and the reality of jailhouse lawyers and how critical and crucial that history is, that those who function in that way and who are able to share that knowledge base around law and how to make filings and how to do all the necessary legal work, which of course is just thrown at those of us who find ourselves on the inside at every turn. And so this is one of these cases, if we're thinking about case law, Ruffin versus Commonwealth,
yes,
out of Virginia, that it arises a great deal in those discourses, you know, from a jailhouse lawyer perspective, those who are focused on questions of prison slavery and how that impacts the experience of those who are designated as enslaved under these kinds of under this kind of legalese. So it quotes it by saying the use instead of language that treated slavery, this is talking about the exception clause, the use instead of language that treated slavery and involuntary servitude together conveyed to the ordinary citizen that the amendment allowed both of them as punishment for crime. And so then it's pointing to a recent example of after the 13th Amendment, as you pointed out, you know, and have on many occasions, the drastic shape of the reshaping and recomposition of the incarcerated population, state after state. You know, you pointed towards South Carolina, which is, of course, a clear-cut example, and there are many others. And so here we're talking about Virginia, 1871, and it says the Virginia Supreme Court accepted that view in 1871 when it characterized a felony prisoner as, quote, the slave of the state. And then there it cites Ruffin versus Commonwealth. So just the starkness of that language in 1871 should help us to see that, you know, across what is pointed toward as this major barrier, this major moment of distinction, There are certainly other questions involved as far as what that meant with respect to slavery and whether or not it could still continue in the United States.
They knew exactly where they were going with it. The Ruffin versus Commonwealth was just like 6 years after the 13th Amendment had been ratified by a sufficient number of states. So you're only 6 years away from it now. You're literally talking about it, right? It's not in way past memory. That was what they were focusing on. Why do we need to do this? Because what are they? Slaves of the state. And convict leasing was the vehicle that actually made that happen. No, I don't want to get into the Juneteenth conversation too much right now because time is still short for us. But I'll say this much. When General Granger came to Galveston, Texas in 1865, talking about General Order Number 3, y'all, all the Negroes is free, y'all, only a year later, not even a year, just months later, Texas began convict leasing in 1867 with the railroads and the mines. And then in 2018, when they found mass graves in Sugar Land, Texas, among other places, of convicts who had been literally worked to death and thrown into mass graves in Texas. All right, let's go ahead and get into the next, as much of this as we can. I'm going to speed through a lot of this, all right? So number six, guideline number six, expropriation. Ordinarily, exclusion from expropriation or security of holding would be deemed a power attaching to the right of ownership. However, as the state generally does not support a property right in persons, a negative obligation against the state generally no longer exists, period. I just want to say for the record, that doesn't apply to the United States or the only nation that actually has slavery as part of our Constitution. However, the state has that minimum positive obligation to bring about the end of either the status or condition of a person over whom any or all of the powers attaching to the right of ownership are exercised. The state may have a further positive obligation with regard to the prohibition against slavery on the basis of domestic law as well as regional or international instruments. So it's basically saying that the state is responsible for ending this within their borders, that you're supposed to stand against this, and that it is not generally that the state is the one actually doing this. But in America, that is exactly how it is, and it's spreading across the globe, as we know. Guideline number seven, terminology. The term slavery has often been utilized to describe circumstances that go beyond the legal definition as established by the 1926 Slavery Convention. In law, only slavery and institutions and practices similar to slavery, which is often abbreviated to practices similar to slavery, have standing and are defined in international law via the 1926 Slavery Convention and the 1956 Supplementary Convention. So only those things in law, slavery, institutions, practices similar to slavery. Those are what's included. Guideline number eight, distinctions between slavery and forced labor. This is where my brother Dennis Spivo said that there was some particular issues. So let's see. The 1926 Slavery Convention recognizes that forced labor can develop into conditions analogous to slavery. Although forced or compulsory labor is defined by the 1934 Labor Convention as all works or services which is exacted from any person under the menace or any penalty and for which she said, for which the said person has not offered himself voluntarily. Forced labor will only amount to slavery when, in substance, there is the exercise of the powers attaching to the right of ownership. Slavery will not be present in cases of forced labor where the control over a person tantamount to possession is not present. We've already shown that that's present at all times. Even if they tell you, we'll give you time off if you work, that's coercion. It doesn't have to be violence. It can be pure coercion. And who would say no to that? If they tell you, we'll do it, we'll give you 20 cents an hour. If you're in an environment where no cents an hour is the usual and there's an economy, 20 cents is a fortune. I remember a brother telling me that a dollar a day was good money. So it's all about the economics of the situation you're dealing with and supply and demand. So sometimes, you know, they'll happily take those pennies because there's nothing else. And somebody got to buy everything that needs to be bought.
Right. And another of those terms that was dropped in that context was deception. And there certainly would seem to be an evidence of a whole lot of that going on with regard to prison slavery.
Yeah, it's beyond just the prison slavery, just with the general public and the education. I mean, now with the bills they're trying to put forth to prevent the actual truth of slavery in America being taught. So that right there is a part of a grand deception. The very idea that we're just still here celebrating Juneteenth coming up, where one in three black men are expected to go to prison, is in itself part of that entire deception. How did you fool all of those people with the stats right in their face? You know, how did you do that? It takes a lot of propaganda to get to that. 400 years of it, at least. All right, guideline number 9, distinction between slavery and institutions and practices similar to slavery. Article 1 of the 1956 Supplementary Convention recognizes that the institutions and practices similar to slavery, that is, debt bondage, we see that happening right now with these fines and fees, which are violations of the Eighth Amendment, serfdom, servile marriages, or child exploitation, may be covered by the definitions of slavery contained in Article 1 of the Slavery Convention of 1926. The distinction between these servile statuses as defined by the 1956 Supplementary Convention in the following terms, and slavery is that slavery where in substance there is the exercise of the powers attaching to the right of ownership. It should be emphasized that slavery will only be present in cases such as institutions and practices similar to slavery, where control over a person tantamount to possession is present. Man, they're driving at home, right? Y'all got to have this. I don't care what it is. If it's not there, it's not slavery.
Right.
The following are conventional servitudes set out by the 1956 Supplementary Convention on the Abolition of Slavery, the slave trade, and institutions and practices similar to slavery. A, debt bondage. That is to say, the status or condition arising from a pledge by a debtor of his personal service or those of a person under his control as security for a debt if the value of those services are reasonably assessed is not applied towards the liquidation of the debt or the length and nature of those services are not respectively limited and defined. Man, that is Vermont state constitution right there. Right now, in their state constitution, it literally says you can be a slave for debts and the like. That's a violation of something that we signed on to right there in their constitution. And Vermont bragged about being the first one to abolish slavery. But the truth is they were the first ones to codify it within their state constitution. It's there right now. Shout out to Brother Mark Hughes, who is leading the charge and has the legislation going through the House right now in Vermont to remove that offensive language and end slavery in Vermont for the first time. Not 1777. In 2022, they're going to do it. All right. B, serfdom. That is to say, the condition or status of a tenant who is by law, custom, or agreement bound to live and labor on land belonging to another person and to render some determinate service to such other person, whether for reward or not, and is not free to change his status. And then C, any institution or practice whereby I, or number one, a woman without the right to refuse is promised or given in marriage or on payment or of a consideration of money or in kind to her parents, guardian, family, or any other person or group or. Two, the husband of a woman, his family, or his clan has the right to transfer her to another person for value, received, or otherwise. Or three, a woman on the death of her husband is liable to be inherited by another person. And then D, any institution or practice whereby a child or young person under the age of 18 years is delivered by either or both of his natural parents or by his guardian to another person, whether for reward or not, with a view to the exploitation of the child or young person or of his labor. I'm starting to think about our youth detention facilities when I hear that. And these adoption agencies that are directly connected to the immigration facilities like that. And even the group homes where people take on these kids, not because they love kids, but because they love that check that comes in every month, you know, and the kids are growing up in hell. Guideline number 10, when slavery and lesser servitude are present, accepting that both slavery and lesser servitude, such as forced labor or institutions and practices similar to slavery, may be found in substance in a particular circumstance, the manner to proceed is by making reference to that substance and not simply to the form, and first ask whether there has been an exercise of the powers attaching to the right of ownership. If so, then the more serious offense of slavery is present. Reference should be made to the legal definition of the lesser servitude, which corresponds in substance to the particular circumstance in question. And this was adopted on March 3rd, 2012, by the members of the Research Network on the Legal Parameters of Slavery. And that is it, right there. We went through the whole thing tonight.
Yes,
That's pretty awesome. So now you know. You ain't got to guess no more. Now you know. And the keywords, over and over again, man, they drove them home. Having established control, tantamount to possession. That's the key. So it starts with possession. Do you think you own me?
Mm.
Do you control my life? Do I get to make a choice at any point? Because if I don't have any choice, then that is tantamount to control over a person, right? Tantamount to possession.
Possession, ownership, control, and just to continue to draw some of the connections that are to be drawn from this Scott Howe article referenced in Sister Ballard's work, which recently published, if I'm not mistaken, right? Marcia Ballard's text. So, and it's right here in the flesh. 2020, it was published, Sister Ballard's Enslavement as Punishment. And part of what was being pointed toward in one of the more recent clips, which was discussing some of the examples of slavery, was discussing Florida specifically, and how also points toward Florida as far as the convict leasing is concerned out of Florida and the particular direction that Florida went in 1869 on page 1010 of Scott Howe's work. It states, in 1869, Florida leased half of its prisoners, and Florida convicts soon found themselves working in railroad construction and in swampy turpentine forests infested with alligators and serpents. And that's supported by none other than Mancini's work, which is referenced heavily here on Abolition Today, as well as J.C. Powell's The American Siberia, or 14 Years Experience in a Southern Convict Camp, published in originally in 1891. So it goes on to just outline some of the particular horrors experienced in Florida in this context. It also certainly, is addressed toward a number of other states where this prison slavery has been grievously enacted. It points another case that is highly cited is Ruiz versus Estelle. Another one that, for example, in Mumia's classic Jailhouse Lawyers, that is certainly cited there, as well as Dennis Child's work, which is called Slaves of the State, which goes into this question, which also cites the Ruffin case, which was mentioned earlier. So another important work that's demonstrating as clearly as possible that here in the wake of this particular amendment and its exception clause, all of these, ongoing instances of enslavement behind imprisonment, and as this was Garrison, right, who referred to slavery as the crime of crimes, that crime of crimes.
Well, we got about 9 minutes or so left that we can cover some ground on, and I still got a track that I want to play. I think we did a real good job tonight of bringing this to the organizers' attention. If we're going to end slavery, we need to be on the same page. And this is the legal definition of slavery. This is how it's defined. These are all the parameters that are required, and we covered them all. And it's very, very certain that we fit the description here in the United States for prison for profit, police for profit. I want to show you through this next audio clip exactly what we're dealing with, what the opposition is about. And it'll be, of course, followed by some music and how they're going to kill us. Remember, Wilmington is the place where white supremacists overthrew the government and took over and killed the black established officials and citizens. That'll be followed by It Could Have Been Me from Holly Mear. When we come back on the other side, we'll thank our sponsors and make our closing comments and then get into our final segment, which is the Bridging the Gap segment. Put together this week by Brother Tag. You're listening to Abolition Today. We'll be right back after this.
Abolition.
The turnout of this story. Tonight, three Wilmington, North Carolina police officers have been fired after a routine audit of a patrol car camera uncovered what authorities describe as extremely racist comments toward African Americans. Here's CBS's Jeff Pagaz.
An internal probe by the Wilmington Police Department reveals hate-filled conversations with three veteran officers. Officer Kevin Piner is heard telling Corporal Jesse Moore that the protests would soon lead to a civil war and that he is ready. He goes on to tell Moore that he was going to buy a new assault rifle and soon we are just going to go out and start slaughtering them expletive N-words. Piner says a civil war is needed to wipe them off the expletive map. That'll put them back about 4 or 5 generations. Later, during a phone call with Piner, Moore refers to a woman he arrested as the N-word and says she needed a bullet in her head right then. Donnie Williams is the department's new police chief. He fired the officers on his first day.
When you talk about killing people and generations of people, that is disturbing.
According to investigators, the officers blame their comments on the stress of today's climate in law enforcement. CBS News has reached out to the police union and the three officers for comment. So far, they haven't responded. Jeff Pagaz, CBS News, Washington.
Students in Ohio, 200 yards away, shot down by a nameless fire one early day in May. Some people cried out angry, you should have shot more of them down. But you can't bury youth, my friend. Youth grows the whole world around. It could have been me, but instead it was you. So I'll keep doing the work you were doing as if I were too. I'll be a student of life, a singer of songs, a farmer of food, and the writer of wrong. It could have been me, but instead it was you. And it may be me, dear sisters and brothers, before we are through. But if you can die for freedom, 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 if you can die for freedom, I can too. The junta took the fingers from Victor Hart's hands. They said to the gentle poet, play your guitar now if you can. Well, Victor started singing until they shot his body down. You can kill a man, but not a song when it's sung the whole world around. And it could have been me, but instead it was you. So I'll keep doing the work you were doing as if I were too. I'll be a student of life, a singer of songs, a farmer of food, and a writer of wrong. It could have been me. but instead it was you. And it may be me, dear sisters and brothers, before we are through. But if you can sing for freedom, 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 if you can sing for freedom, I can too. A woman in the jungle, so many wars away, studies late into the night, defends a village in the day. Although her skin is golden, like mine will never be, her song is heard and I know the words, and I'll sing them till she is free. It could have been me, but instead it was you. So I'll keep doing the work you were doing as if I were to. I'll be a student of life, a singer of songs, a farmer of food, and the writer of wrong. It could have been me, but instead it was you. And it may be me, dear sisters and brothers, before we are through. But if you can work for freedom, 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 freedom,
slaughter all of us niggas. That was followed by Could Have Been Me from Holly Neal. I want to thank you for tuning in tonight with us here at Abolition Today, myself and Tag Harmon. Thank you, Tag, for assisting again.
Oh, brother, without question, thank you, Abolitionist Center here. This is Paul Cuffey, Abolitionist Center. Thank you to Abolition Today, to the Black Talk Radio Network, to Jailhouse Lawyer Speak. So we got Jailhouse Lawyer Speak, I Am We Ubuntu, Saima Urge, as was mentioned, Paul Cuffey Abolitionist Center, Prismatic Dreams, and as was also mentioned, Black Talk Radio Network.
Word. That's our friends, our partners, our sponsors that make this possible and give us the opportunity to spread this information as far and wide as we can. You could have been anywhere, but you're here with, we're here with us today, and we really appreciate it. Hopefully, we provided the information in the way we had hoped that you can use. And that is regarding the Bellagio Harbor guidelines on the legal parameters of slavery. And don't forget what the key word is, the key words of it, and that is control, tantamount to possession. You have to establish control, tantamount to possession. So it begins with control. All right, we're going to close this out with our Bridging the Gap segment. This week it's going to be William Lloyd Garrison's subscribe to our YouTube page, youtube.com, Abolition Today, for all the news, information, and music you heard on the program today. Show some love to the artists. They deserve it, right? And Abolition Today is available on all major podcast platforms and is simulcast on the Black Talk Radio Network. Also, remember to join the movement at abolishslavery.us to become a part of the solution. We'll be back next week and bring you another masterclass on slavery abolition. Until then, think about abolition today.
Abolition. Abolition.
This narrative contains many affecting incidents, many passages of great eloquence and power. But I think the most thrilling one of them all is the description Douglas gives of his feelings as he stood soliloquizing respecting his fate and the chances of his one day being a free man on the banks of the Chesapeake Bay, viewing the receding vessels as they flew with their white wings before the breeze and apostrophizing them as animated by the living spirit of freedom. Who can read that passage and be insensible to its pathos and sublimity? Compressed into it is a whole Alexandrian library of thought, feeling, and sentiment. All that need be urged in the form of expostulation, entreaty, rebuke against that crime of crimes, making man the property of his fellow man. Oh, how accursed is that system, which entombs the godlike mind of man, defaces the divine image, reduces those who by creation were crowned with glory and honor to a level with four-footed beasts, and exalts the dealer in human flesh above all that is called God. Why should its existence be prolonged 1 hour? Is it not evil, only evil, and that continually? What does its presence imply but the absence of all fear of God, all regard for man on the part of the people of the United States? Heaven's speed, its eternal overthrow. So profoundly ignorant of the nature of slavery are many persons that they are stubbornly incredulous whenever they read or listen to any recital of the cruelties which are daily inflicted on its victims. They do not deny that the slaves are held as property, but that terrible fact seems to convey to their minds no idea of injustice, exposure to outrage, or savage barbarity. Tell them of cruel scourgings, of mutilations and brandings, of scenes of pollution and blood, of the banishment of all light and knowledge, and they affect to be greatly indignant at such enormous exaggerations, such wholesale misstatements, such abominable libels on the character of the Southern planters. As if all these direful outrages were not the natural results of slavery. As if it were less cruel to reduce a human being to the condition of a thing than to give him a severe flagellation, or to deprive him of necessary food and clothing. As if whips, chains, thumb screws, paddles, bloodhounds, overseers, drivers, patrols were not all indispensable to keep the slaves down and to give protection to their ruthless oppressors. As if, when the marriage institution is abolished, concubinage, adultery, and incest must not necessarily abound. When all the rights of humanity are annihilated, any barrier remains to protect the victim from the fury of the spoiler. When absolute power is assumed over life and liberty, it will not be wielded with destructive sway. Skeptics of this character abound in society. In some few instances, their incredulity arises from a want of reflection, but generally it indicates a hatred of the light, a desire to shield slavery from the assaults of its foes, a contempt of the colored race, whether bond or free. Such will try to discredit the shocking tales of slaveholding cruelty which are recorded in this truthful narrative, but they will labor in vain. Mr. Douglas has frankly disclosed the place of his birth, the names of those who claimed ownership in his body and soul, and the names also of those who committed the crimes which he has alleged against them. His statements, therefore, may easily be disproved if they are untrue. In the course of his narrative, he relates two instances of murderous cruelty, in one of which a planter deliberately shot a slave belonging to a neighboring plantation who had unintentionally gotten within his lordly domain in quest of fish. And in the other, an overseer blew out the brains of a slave who had fled to a stream of water to escape a bloody scourging. Mr. Douglas states that in neither of these instances was anything done by way of legal arrest or judicial investigation. The Baltimore American of March 17, 1845, relates a similar case of atrocity perpetrated with similar impunity as follows. Shooting a slave. We learn upon the authority of a letter from Charles County, Maryland, received by a gentleman of this city, that a young man named Matthews, a nephew of General Matthews, and whose father, it is believed, holds an office at Washington, killed one of the slaves upon his father's farm by shooting him. The letter states that young Matthews had been left in charge of the farm, that he gave an order to the servant, which was disobeyed. When he proceeded to the house, obtained a gun, and returning, shot the servant. He immediately, the letter continues, fled to his father's residence, where he still remains, unmolested. End of quote. Let it never be forgotten that no slaveholder or overseer can be convicted of any outrage perpetrated on the person of a slave, however diabolical it may be, on the testimony of colored witnesses, whether bond or free. By the slave code, they are judged to be as incompetent to testify against a white man as though they were indeed a part of the brute creation. Hence, there is no legal protection in fact, whatever there may be in form, for the slave population. And any amount of cruelty may be inflicted on them with impunity. Is it possible for the human mind to conceive of a more horrible state of society? The effect of a religious profession on the conduct of Southern masters is vividly described in the following narrative, and shown to be anything but salutary. In the nature of the case, it must be in the highest degree pernicious. The testimony of Mr. Douglas on this point is sustained by a cloud of witnesses whose veracity is unimpeachable. A slaveholder's profession of Christianity is a palpable imposture. He is a felon of the highest grade. He is a man-stealer. It is of no importance what you put in the other scale. Reader, are you with the man-stealers in sympathy and purpose, or on the side of their downtrodden victims? If with the former, then you are the foe of God and man. If with the latter, what are you prepared to do and dare in their behalf? Be faithful, be vigilant, be untiring in your efforts to break every yoke and let the oppressed go free. Come what may, cost what it may, inscribe on the banner which you unfurl to the breeze as your religious and political motto, no compromise with slavery, no union with slaveholders. William Lloyd Garrison, Boston, May 1st, 1845.
When the work was so hard, and the user said, till their refusal. So do you remember the days of slavery? Hold up. It's my destiny.
majesty, his imperial majesty, Mama Africa, Mama Africa, Mama Africa, high and high and high and high and proud, the African Jamaican, African American, African West Indian, African Caribbean, African European, high and high and high and proud. African His majesty, His imperial majesty, Rastafari. His majesty, His majesty, His majesty, His majesty, His majesty, His majesty,
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kid's PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.